3, we have members present, Representative Guttenberg, Representative T. Wilson, Vice Chair Fairclough, as in Tough, Stoltz, Representative Dugan, Representative Edgman, Representative Costello, as in Abbott, and Representative Newman, as in Seinfeld. Hey, man, I get the jocularity out of my
What's in the water? What's in the water?
Newman.
We have two bills up before us today. House Bill 115, naming the Walter J. Hickel Expressway, and House Bill 361, disposal of state resources. And just for the public's awareness, I will repeat that we're having public testimony on House Bill 9. That's the in-state gas proposal by Representative Chenault and Hawker. Testimony from 6:30 to 9 tonight, and then again tomorrow from 5 to 8. And then this afternoon we will bring that bill. We've had the amendments that have been offered by members posted online and in the public domain so that folks could see the proposed amendments. It's our intent to use part of this afternoon's meeting to dispense with those amendments. I take them up and have them offered. So with that, we'll jump right into House Bill 115. Welcome, Representative Johnson, and anybody you wish to bring with you.
Oh, I brought the A-team, Mr. Chairman.
And also joined by Representative Guerra.
For the donors.
Welcome, Mr. Rule.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Today before you is House Bill. For the record, my name is Craig Johnson, District 28 in South Anchorage. Today we have before you House Bill 115, which is renaming or co-naming the Minnesota Bypass, the Walter J. Hickel Bypass. I don't think I need to do a lot of discussion on who Mr. Hickel was. This road, if you're familiar, is Minnesota. It starts downtown and runs all the way right through, not very far from where Wally Hickel's business was, where he lives. And it is the northern boundary and eastern boundary of my district. This comes at the request, and it's just time we honored Walter Hickel. I know there's several things out there for him. There are some, and I can't think of anything more appropriate than a road for a man who was pro-development. He wanted to see Alaska grow.
A new
road. Well, in terms of Alaska, Mr. Chairman, this is a new road. We haven't built very many lately, and I think this was the one built prior to the Elmore stuff. This was the newest road until those were built. And with me today, I have Yasmin Habash, who is my staff, to present. I'm going to curse her by saying this is her first presentation, so be kind. So with that, any questions you might have of her, and I'll let her go ahead and present the bill. Thank you.
Welcome, Ms. Kabosh.
Good morning. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Yasmin Habash, and I'm staff to Representative Johnson. I'm here to present House Bill 115. House Bill 115 is to reconcurrently name a 7.5-mile portion of Minnesota Drive and O'Malley Road in Anchorage, the Walter J. Hickel Expressway, which extend from 15th Avenue to the new Seward Highway. By concurrently designating this section of road, no establishments will be required to change their addresses. Throughout his long and distinguished career, Walter J. Hickel served as governor of Alaska twice and as U.S. Secretary of the Interior under President Richard Nixon, and advocated for the development of the state of Alaska and the circumpolar Arctic region. In his many elected and public roles, he successfully opened Prudhoe Bay to oil development and oversaw the permitting process for the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. We believe that concurrently naming the section of road is fitting, as Governor Hickel was a great advocate for public roads and transportation. Thank you for taking the time to consider this bill, and I can answer any questions that you may have.
the Representative Johnson or Ms. Kibosh. It's in Anchorage, and we have the Eisenhower Corridor, is it, which goes down the AC couplet. Is this a similar concept to that in rename ANC Street?
That is correct, Mr. Chairman. And part of the reason for this is we don't want everyone along that road to have to change their stationery and have the private expense of doing that. I think that's one of the reasons we wanted to.
Similar to the Veterans
Memorial. Very similar to a lot of the things we've done that we co-name.
Well, for the record, that folks, that has been an issue when renaming well-intentioned. This is probably the more preferred an existing road. This is probably the more thoughtful, appropriate approach.
Mr. Chairman, if I might, we thought about at one point naming just the portion from International Airport to O'Malley, because there are no businesses there that would have to suffer those consequences. But I think in terms of honoring this great Alaskan, we wanted to go ahead and do it this way to go the whole 10 yards.
Questions from the committee?
Why not the Hall Road?
Representative Costello.
Through the chair, I actually don't have a question, but I just wanted to point the members out to a particularly touching letter from Governor Hickel's wife, Irma Lee.
And I do want to add that we do have family support for this. This is not something that was sprung on them, and they are supportive of it, as are the other members of the family who have contacted me personally and not written letters, but the sons and grandchildren of Walter Hickel.
Representative Thomas,
yeah. Why not the Hall Road? Isn't that just called the Hall Road?
Dalton.
Well, you know, I certainly wouldn't want to compete with the Dalton family.
That is, and I think Mike Dalton, Kathleen Mike Dalton of Fairbanks, that's named after her late husband, and he had a significant role, and certainly, I believe when it was named, I think it had the support of former Governor Hickel, or maybe.
And through the chair, Representative Thomas, this road does run right past his business, very close to his business, right close to his home, and it is in Anchorage, which was his home, and so appropriately, at least in the eyes of the sponsor, that was the most logical target, because we don't have anyone. I don't want to insult anyone from Minnesota, but that's not a terribly Alaskan family name.
We have one person to testify. So Mr. Wickersham from Anchorage OffNet. Are you there, sir?
Good morning, and thanks for the opportunity to testify on this. I think everything has been said on this subject. I strongly support this bill and hope that you pass it out and hope it becomes law. I think the only thing that I would add is that yeah, this is nothing against the state of Minnesota. I grew up in Minnesota. I was part of the planning of the original Minnesota bypass, and I don't know, more than 30 years ago, and I've always thought of it as a temporary name, and I think that this is a completely appropriate name. This governor is missed and held in the hearts of everyone in Alaska, and I certainly hope that you see fit to pass the bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Wickersham? Thank you very much, Mr. Wickersham, for your testimony. Is there anybody else from the public wishing to testify? Off net or in? We'll close the public testimony. I mean, the next most significant part is we're going to build a few signs. It's going to cost a few bucks. And we have a fiscal note. I know those are the very large. These are going to be the brown signs, Representative.
Mr. Chairman, we asked the department to design that. We're not going to get into sign design, but I think that we'll do something appropriate for the governor. We'll try to walk them through that and make sure that it's something that it's not a small sign. People will know where they are.
I know. We had discussions informally with the Department of Transportation on our veterans' highways about having something that had a more patriotic theme than just the brown signs, and I think that's appropriate, not to get into the debate of the color scheme and stuff. We've redesigned the license this year already, so we'll call that a big victory.
Yeah, and Mr. Chairman, my art ability would be lacking, so I wouldn't even want to get into that discussion. That would be, it might not be a pretty sign if I were involved.
Representative Fairclough. Representative Guttenberg, before we get to this.
And thank you for coming for us today, because artability is a new word in our
Artability. I like that.
I have a great respect for the for the governor and you know the owner state concept that he come out named. I just want to make sure that you can drive on this vehicle on this road now with every vehicle that drove on it before, and you don't need to require to drive a bulldozer.
Through the chair, I know you said that lightly, but I'm pretty sure they're not going to allow snow machines and four wheelers on this road as well. So no, it's a general transportation road, and a bulldozer might not hurt. It would we could extend that around. It would be a nice addition. So I'm not going to be terribly opposed to extending it. So,
Representative Thomas,
thank you, Co-Chair. Co-Chair, I think if DOT is listening, it should be appropriate for a governor. That's all I'm going to say.
Thank you. Representative Dugan.
And Mr. Chairman, over the time that I was in Inc. State Ranch, I had many encounters with Governor Hickel. Some of them might have been characterized as run-ins. And I can say a couple of things about him. Thank you. One is that he was a man of firm principles and never backed down if he thought he was right. And along with Bill Egan, I think that he's probably the most important politicians anyway, in the sort of last half of the 20th century. So I'm happy to support this. I hope that other people, as they whiz by on the bypass, might notice the name and think that maybe they should know more about the guy. So anyway, thank you, Mr.
Chairman. I think he probably put a much deeper imprint on Alaska than we can ever recognize with a sign. I think it's just how our Representative Edmund.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Obviously there's strong support for this measure, and I think it's while we take a moment here to remember a great Alaskan, I think I'd go a step further by saying that he was one of the greatest visionaries of the state as well. But I recall when he came in as governor, was it 1990? There was definitely some trepidation among the ranks of rural leaders, not having any understanding what he might stand for, and the whole notion about the bulldozer and the road and this, that, and the other. When he left office, there were a lot of rural leaders who were pretty concerned that he wasn't going to run for a second term. And I remember back working with the staff to get the first Alaska Native appointed North Pacific Fishery Council. He was a friend with us in the Board of Fish and Appointments. He did a lot for the water and sewer program, a lot of money through the administration in the water and sewer program throughout rural Alaska. And, put a lot of oomph behind the then Raven Commission with Edgar Blatchford and all the efforts that extended out beyond Road System Alaska. So just to take a moment to remember, have the record maybe reflect a lot of what he did back, at least in the short time serving Alaska as during the second term of governor.
Sam Schull.
When he first got into the office, I thought the man was a little crazy.
The man was crazy?
Because of the prior statement from Representative Edgman. I guess I didn't really understand the concept of somebody having a vision. And things like sending our melting glacial water to California or a tunnel west from Alaska over to Russia, I thought, were just completely out of this world. And as I've advanced chronologically, I've come to a place where I think you know, those are really good ideas, and had we had shared some of that vision back then, maybe we could have advanced our place, because they really weren't outlandish. Having said that, I guess looking forward, I hope that prompts us to do no less looking forward, because this is a good tribute to a man who maybe went in questionable in terms of how we thought about him, but there was no question when he left office and was done.
Representative Guerra.
Thank you. I suppose I should largely agree with Representative Jewell. You know, I was at the Attorney General's office when Governor Hickel was elected, and as a Democrat who didn't share a lot of the views that he campaigned on, I thought, well, he should have people working at the Attorney General's office who share his philosophy and who could pursue his vision, and I probably wasn't the right person. So at the time the Exxon Valdez case was coming to an end, I figured it was time, I'll move on and I'll let somebody else work for him. But I was very pleasantly surprised by what he did as a governor. He actually walked the walk in terms of sort of, he said he would stand up for Alaska. He did stand up for Alaska in his own way, which I think was the way that many of us would have too. And he proved to be a pretty independent-minded guy who I think did a lot of good for the state. So as a Democrat, I can say I'm a fan of Governor Hickel's, and he made me into a fan after I left the AG's office.
I'd like to talk about my sharp memories the first time he was elected, but I was 5 years old in 1966, and he beat a fairly iconic Alaskan, Bill Egan, who probably as much the third term beat Bill Egan as anything else. I don't think there was a governor over two terms that had more impact on Alaska in two different times in Alaska. But, is there any other comments? The fiscal note.
Mr. Chairman, I direct the committee to the OMB component number 564. The allocation is going to the Central Region Highway and Aviation. FY13 is a one-time allocation of $30,000, general fund dollars, and those are for signs to recognize where people will be driving.
Any questions on the fiscal note? Any amendments? None. Okay. Representative.
Mr. Chairman, I move from committee to CS for House Bill number 115, Transportation 27-LS0345-B, with attached fiscal note and individual committee recommendations.
Hearing no objection, Ms. Kibosh, you're one for one. You can only go down from here. So we'll take a very brief at ease to sign the committee report. House Finance, come back to order. It is at 9:27. We're reconvening to take up House Bill 361, disposal of state resources. We're going to have a presentation of the bill. The administration has noticed some technical errors. We want to point those out on the record, and it's our intent to address those in a committee substitute. But we want to air on the record the issues, and rather than go through an amendment process. So, Mr. Winifie, welcome.
Hello. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Win Menifee, Chief of Operations for the Division of Mining, Land, and Water for the Department of Natural Resources. And I appreciate you giving me the opportunity to talk to you just momentarily about HB 361. The intent of this is to make some changes in statutes that will lend toward permit efficiencies. Last year, we came before the legislature and legislature made some appropriations toward the division to work on permit efficiencies, both with our backlog.
We made them. You recommended them.
Yeah. I recommended. And I put in a work plan, essentially, to say this is what we're trying to accomplish. And one of the things that we put in that work plan was that we were going to identify statutes that might be used to add toward permit efficiencies. We went through and identified a bunch and then vetted that through the governor's office, and we narrowed it down to the ones that you see in this bill. And these are meant to provide either better timeliness, more certainty, potentially address some potential litigation risk, and ideas is to reduce the time and cost to the applicant and free up some staff time to work on other issues. So I'd be happy to go through this in any different way. Would you like me to just go through and hit the high points?
Let's go through and hit the high points, and folks can flag questions. We'll let you get through your testimony, and then also in that process, we'd also like you to identify some of the corrective language we need to address, or you would recommend us addressing.
Okay.
You and the Department of Law, I believe.
So what I'd like to do is you're working off of the briefing paper that you have in your packet, and briefing paper of March 21st. The bill covers a few different topics. Any of these topics do not necessarily change and make a huge difference. What it does is incrementally makes differences and creates efficiencies, and cumulatively we're going to see efficiencies and free up staff time. So that's good. The first thing is we'd like to move more leases under the negotiated lease process versus competitive lease process. And the main issue here is that when we go through per statutes the way they read now, when we do a competitive leasing process, what we have to do is we have to first produce an auction brochure. We have to notify the public again. The applicant pays for that second notice that goes out. We have to wait 30 days for that period of time before we actually hold the auction. And you go through all those steps. What happens a lot of times is nobody's interested besides the applicant. This isn't like oil and gas leasing or timber sales where you go out and you just offer up a whole bunch of land. This is where somebody's come and asked us for the parcel of land. So the idea being is we would like to go and first ask the people, the public, is there competitive interest in this parcel? If there is no competitive interest, then it doesn't make sense to spend that extra time and cost to go through the competitive process. So that's the biggest change there. Secondarily in that, to get more under the leasing process, is it was before 1984 was the last time the leasing amendments or the leasing statutes were revised. There is a cap that the legislature had put in there that allows the division to go directly to negotiate without going competitive if the lease is the lease value is below $5,000 or less than 10 years.
Mr. Renfee, just one observation. It's our Division of Legislative Affairs that does a short title. So the disposals of state resources is an inadequate short title, isn't it? Would that be your observation?
There's a lot of things in here is more than just disposal.
And it's often leasing. It might be a misnomer to just think of it as the state relieving itself of resources. If you've talked about leases almost predominantly. So.
Right. Well, and disposals of land and materials, disposals, lease is a disposal of land, and it's a disposal of interest. And we're required to go through a 3805-35 decision, best interest decision. So I'll go back to the
back to your
the threshold part. The threshold being that at $5,000, we're saying over these years costs have gone up and consumer price index, and so we're just saying let's raise that bar up to $10,000. Just it'll allow a few more leases to come in under the direct negotiation. So that's the first issue is about leasing, putting more under negotiated leases. The second is when we have leases, they can range all the way up to 55 years, but there are different terms depending on what people are putting on the land. When a lease comes to the end of its term, the current statute requires to go through it back through a full competitive process again, even though somebody's already developed something on the land. What we're saying is if somebody's in good standing, they've already put the infrastructure there that they said they were going to do, and they've made all their payments, they're abiding by the terms, then what we'd like to do is just solicit and find out, is there any competitive interest? If there's not any competitive interest in that land, then we'd like to renew that lease and just go directly to renewal. And this, once again, would save a lot of time for both the applicant or the lessee and for us. And so it's essentially renewal option when somebody's in good standing. The number three here on the briefing paper, we've had in the statutes, the way they currently read, timber sales and material sales are commingled. And the way it works is that it's a little bit tough to tease out which you're talking about, whether it's timber or material, in some of the statutes. What we're doing is we're separating those in this proposal. Is what we want to do is we want to have the timber sales talk about timber sales, the material sales talk about material sales. So the current statutes would say timber sales, materials, we'd set up a new statute for those. In doing that, we also were making a modification of how we do material sales, and this is also for efficiencies, is right now you have to do a best interest decision on every single material sale you go out for, and that means public notice of full decision process. What we'd like to be able to do is when you have a site that you're going to sell materials out of, designate a site. Say, let's say it's 15 acres. We're going to designate 15 acres. We're going to take all the material from there, and we're going to sell all the material out of there. Tell the public about that. Make sure everybody understands. Address any issues that come up. Once you've done that, though, then any sales that come out of that site, you just make the sales. You don't have to go through another best interest decision on that. We just say we've already made that up front. So that would be the main change, and that's a lot of efficiency. It would save the applicant's time of the people that are getting materials, and it would save less time and save costs. We also made some other changes in this section of the bill that deal with materials. And a couple other things are, one, on the amount that people pay for the materials. Right now, we have to sell for appraised fair market value. Those appraisals that we have to do for all these material sales, those are expensive. If you're especially in rural Alaska, costs go up because you have to oftentimes fly in an appraiser and have them do that. So if we're going to offer sales, what we'd like to do is we'd like to be able to do that under the representative regional sales price. There's already statutes and regulations in effect that we set up these representative regional sales price by doing an inventory of what the costs are for materials in a region, and we set a representative sales price. We're saying we'd like to be able to sell it for that, and then if somebody wants to, they can get an appraisal, and they can challenge that price and say, I think I should be paying less. Here's an appraisal. Well, if we approve the appraisal and it's less, well, we'll sell it for less. But the idea is let's make it less costly for the applicant, because what we found historically is our representative regional sales price really close to an appraisal. So it just seems like extra money for the applicant. Then I'll move on into, there's one part of the bill that deals with selling gravel.
When you say in one part, why don't you reference this section in the paper?
Okay. So, for instance, we're section 18 of the bill, there's a portion where we're conveying materials for less than fair market value. Now, what we've set up is in an instance where you have material coming down rivers and such that's causing flooding. We're saying that we'd like to be able to sell that for less than fair market value, because what the state's having to do is when you have floods, you have to do emergency response, you have to repair roads, bridges, things like that. We don't, when we could get the gravel out of there, then less likely to have those costs incurred by the state. So the idea is let's bring it less than fair market value so people will take the gravel out of there and have less flooding.
Can, given where you live, you know, extraction of gravel from the Kinnick River to channel deeper for flood control, would that be an example?
That probably wouldn't be an example.
Wouldn't?
Because that would be an erosion issue that's a typical erosion. A better example would be like in Seward, where you get this excess deposit of gravel that comes down every year from the mountains and really fills up that, so that the river is higher than the surrounding land, which then ends up flooding the surrounding land. In that case, the deposition material is directly related to the excess of flooding and damage that happens in that area. So that would be a cleaner example. Valdez is probably similar to it. There are probably other areas around the state that, and that's different from just general erosion and flooding issues that happen. You do have deposition of material on the Kinnick and Nisga River, but I think this is more focused on where that deposition of material is getting so high that it's causing the flooding. Now, somebody could try to make that case in any river. So that's basically, we would have to get a plan in that we'd review to make sure that that's what's happening before we would use this. So that's just some highlights for the material portion. And then I would like to move over into temporary water use permits or temporary water use authorizations. These are temporary authorizations that we use for the taking of water for construction projects. Oil and gas industry uses it, mining, building a lodge. And they're all using water oftentimes to make concrete and whatever, or just keep the dust down on roads. They take those from streams, rivers, lakes, and that taking of water is authorized under temporary water use authorization. Well, right now, those are temporary, and they're 5 years. We have to reissue a new one at the end of the 5 years if they're continuing the project. We have many projects that last longer than 5 years. What we'd like to propose is that if the same amount of water is being taken from the same source for the same purpose, and you have the same construction project going on, then let us renew that at, as we come up on the five-year period. And that way, we don't have to go through as much effort on that. Now, we would obviously review and find out, are there other demands on that water? Is there a reason why we shouldn't continue that same water use authorization? So it's not a mandate that you'll issue it again, but it's an option to. But once again, it would save time and money. And then point five in the briefing paper, there's several sections, sections 1 through 4, sections 7 through 9. And then this area is where the Department of Law found a few other corrections that we missed when we first went through there. But essentially, all of these changes deal with public auction versus sealed bid. Now, our land sale program, which I'm sure most of you are familiar with, we sell a lot of land. We use sealed bid procedure all the time. But what's happened is over the time, different statutes were created, wording was used a little differently. And in some places it said public auction, sometimes it said public auction and sealed bid, and there's a confusion whether the one includes the other. And so what we're doing is the Department of Law advised us, wherever we're talking about public auction, we should be making that consistent and talk about it the same way, which gives us the option to use sealed bid. So, as the chairman asked to have me identify that the Department of Law did find some other locations where we hadn't put it in the bill, they found about three other places where we probably need to reference that. And then number six, where we're talking about notices. Right now, when we go out and we do a disposal of interest, what we do is we are required to go out and notify the public about those, and there's a very succinct way we're supposed to do it. We use newspapers, we use post office, we use online public notice. We put out legal notices referring to the online public notice. What we're trying to do is we're trying to transition to say the online public notice is the key place where people should go to find out if anything's happening in Nebraska. And so this bill, this section of where it's sections 19 and 20 are dealing with making an emphasis on the online public notice. But let me clarify that as we're doing that, that we will not be not using papers. We will still use papers. We will still put display ads in papers. We will still put notices in post offices. But this is an emphasis about the online public notice. And 84% of Alaskans have access to the Internet. So we're pretty heavy use in Alaska with the Internet.
You know, Mr. Winnifee, the Mattsu Borough, which I represent, he's my constituent, that's why there's a little more familiarity. You know what the Frontiersman has in paid subscriptions in a community of about 90,000? Just
the Frontiersman has 7,000 distribution.
I don't think that's – I said paid. I don't think
– I don't know if I,
that's
I
what they
that part, but yeah.
Yeah, and I'd like to add is I know they don't have seven. They'd be a thriving enterprise if they were selling 7,000 papers. But I think they must give a lot of those away.
So, okay.
Much like you give away entertainment guides at restaurants and stuff. Anyway, it's probably editorializing about editorials.
Right. Well, Chairman, I did do a little run here of information on that, and found out that the top five papers for distribution in Alaska reach 14% of the population of Alaska. And once again, I just want to reemphasize, this is not saying that we will stop using papers. We will still be putting display ads in papers. But the idea is we're emphasizing the online public notice. All right, well, then I'll move on to the next, which is point seven there. This is in section 13 of the bill. This deals with mining royalties. And what we have is very few miners are paying production royalty, it ends up. And the issue is that the Alaskan laws talks about net royalty or net profit royalties. And so basically you can exempt out the amount of cost it takes to produce the gold or whatever you're pulling out of the ground. Well, what we find is when people go through that, the end product is they don't pay royalty because their costs are too much to take it out. So especially when we're talking about the lower volumes of production, we've done some statistics and found out that when somebody has a gross production of $10,000, there's only two people in the state that actually paid any royalty on that. So the point is there's very little royalty at this bottom part, but we still do audits, we still review, make the compiling of the paperwork and such. And we think that we could do save some staff time going through this, where the state's not losing revenue on this. They're not getting any royalty right now. We're saying, let's just give an exemption for those folks. But the actual threshold would be based upon their gross production. And secondly, we would do that by regulation.
Well, actually, we're going to let him finish. I've got a list of people. I'm sorry. I forgot my protocol.
Okay, I will continue on.
Write you down on the list.
The next one is mining royalty law, which deals with when people file their royalty payments. And the deal is that the federal income tax gives you an option which year you're going to file your by calendar year or by fiscal year, and then mining license tax done by the department or managed by the Department of Revenue gives you the choice. It just has to match the federal income tax. And then ours said you only had to do it by fiscal year. And so what we're saying is we can do a calendar or fiscal year, so you can be in sync with your mining license tax filings and your federal returns. And so basically it's convenience for the miners to be able to keep it all in sync. Lastly, the last highlight is on submerged land leases or submerged mining leases. you've probably heard about a little bit of gold rush up in Nome. That's where we have the submerged mining leases. These are can be substantial in size, but the point is that people have to invest a fair amount of money to do these offshore mining leases because they have to have equipment to pull that gold up. And as they're doing it, that we issue it for 20 years. As long as somebody stays in production at their 20-year mark, the law already says that they will get an extension of a year, or basically it will be automatically renewed for another year if they are making production. So they go year by year by year thereafter. Well, that's not real good for a business to make get loans and things like that to get equipment. So what we would like to do is give more surety or certainty for the business. If they're in good standing and they still have plenty of resource left to explore in their lease, we'd like to be able to renew their 20-year lease. And the issue, so there is a protection, is that if they don't produce, the department does have the ability to pull out of that lease if they're not producing. So they don't get to just lock it up. So there's a fail-safe in there, but the idea is we want to give the certainty for the business to be able to have predictability about whether they have the land right there to be mining. So that's what that's about.
Okay, we're going to start the questions. We have just let people know where they are. Guttenberg, Costello, Newman, Faircloth, and then Guerra. So
starting with Mr. Guttenberg. On page 9, section E at the top, starting at line 2, you limit the personal use of extraction to 2 yards. I imagine this is somebody backing up to a gravel pit and shoveling in gravel or peat or some such thing like that. Have you had feedback on the appropriate people wanting more, or has there been any comment on that over the years?
Representative through the chair, what we have had over the years is a we'll call it a fundamental problem here, is that there was no provision in our statutes that allowed free use for small quantities. If somebody wanted to go out and get a 5-gallon pail of material, they had to pay us for it. They had to go through a whole disposal process for that. There was no exception. And so we have constantly had people come in, and they'd call up and say, I'd like to take this very small quantity. And we'd say, really? And they'd say, yeah. And we say, well, then you're going to have to go through this long process. Oh, I'll call you back. And then they ran off the phone, and that was the last you hear about it. Okay, well, so we knew there was this extraction type stuff going on all the time. But we didn't have any legal way to deal with it. What this is saying is we understand people put gravel on their driveway. They may need just a little piece of material or rock for their garden or whatever. This is the type of stuff that we don't want to waste our time on. And so what we're saying is without cost, up to 2 cubic yards, that's not a lot of material. And that's for a calendar year. So it's a very small and consequential amount. We're thinking that that is appropriate. And it does say, though, material from a site or source designated. So if that doesn't actually cover somebody just going anywhere they want and pulling material, this is still constrained to a place where we've already identified it's okay to take material. And the reason why I'm saying that is there has been the concern when we start talking about this is, well, what about the cumulative effect? What if 1,000 people go to that same site? Then you have 2,000 cubic yards pulled out of there. What we're saying is if you designate a site, even if it's whether it's a river, whether it's a uplands or wherever, but you've already gone through the figuring out whether it's an okay place to pull from gravel, then for that small amount, just let them have it, and it's not going to hurt the state.
I have to admit, I hate to admit that I watched Gavel to Gavel. I watched part of the resource meeting. This is the issue Alan, Representative Alan Dick, was talking about peat and some other items. Is that part of the issue?
Mr. Chairman, this that was just asked is not actually part of the peat part. But there is a section right below that, F, that does deal with peat. And that also has a provision now. That was an amendment that was put in during House Resources that does allow personal use by an individual up to 200 cubic yards for peat. Now, the whole part of F was created for incentivizing peat extraction to try to create a market for heat and power production, especially in the rural communities. The idea is to try to get people to have an alternative fuel source so they're not having to haul as much hydrocarbons up the rivers. And so this is saying if we can get a peat market established, then that's a good thing. This is just saying let's remove any burden or any hurdles from the state side of saying, can you attract peat for a very low cost?
Okay, I'll try not to repeat that point again. next we have Representative Costello.
I actually didn't have any questions. Thank you.
Okay, then Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In the first section, you talked about disposal of land. And I'm trying to figure out in my mind how that would work. If I wanted to buy some land from the state, is there limits on the amount of land you can purchase? Is it 10 acres, 20 acres, 30 acres, 50 acres? How does that process go if we want to purchase land from the state?
Representative through the chair, if you're really talking about purchasing versus leasing or something like that, if we're talking about purchasing, the way that we have available for people to purchase land is where we have our land sale program. And we have the remote recreational cabin site program. We have a subdivision sale program. Those are the two. And then there's an agricultural land sale program also. But essentially, it's where we identify, people nominate areas for sale. We decide if we're going to dispose of those areas. And then once we do, we offer it up to auction, whether it's through sealed bid or public auction. And what we do is then they could be anywhere. I've seen them as big, like the agricultural parcels are usually larger, but on like subdivision sales, they're usually in the 5 to 10 acre range, one to, I guess, 10 acre range. But then the remote recreational sale program, I think you can get up to 20 acres. So.
Mr. Chair, my question was, if somebody went to the state and wanted to purchase state land under Section 1, which talks about sale of state land, this modifies the process, as you said. Can a person contact Division of Land, Mine, and Water, one of the departments within DNR? Do you put in a request to purchase a parcel of land? Is there a, because this gets rid of a competitive bid type process, can the department negotiate with that individual on the sale of that land?
By the statute, we would have the capability of doing it, but the practice of what we do is we do not entertain sale of state land outside of our normal land disposal sale procedures, which is the subdivision sale, the remote recreational sale. If somebody wants to just say they identify a parcel and they just want that parcel for whether it's commercial or for private, we will entertain leasing that land. And there is, if somebody invests enough in the land and it's a long-term lease, a person can come under a preference right for the sale of the land after a long-term lease. But we take them through the leasing procedure to make sure that somebody is really panning out on their investment on the land before you're going to dispose of land, other than through our normal sale procedure.
And, Mr. Chair, the reason I want some clarification on that is because the ability now for the department to streamline the public process for notification. You know, I mean, if they're going to be disposing of land, we would not want to be streamlining that part. We want to make sure that everybody has that opportunity. My other question had to deal with the Section 23, temporary water use and land sales or use of waters. My concerns that I have on that is that I currently am working with a constituent that has been having issues with the department. There's a gentleman that's got a dog training facility, and so he dug out a bunch of land next to the lake so he could train his dogs, and he was pumping water from the lake into those ponds that he created, drew down the water, and we had a bunch of homeowners on this lake, but the water level went down about 8 feet. And that can be through naturally occurring instances, I know in Wisconsin where I grew up, some of the lakes just basically went dry, I mean, for a few years, and then all of a sudden water was coming up. The aquifer changes. And if we don't go back and allow, and what I see this bill doing too, obviously we're giving the department a lot more authority and discretion than what they currently have. We're giving them a lot more rights than what they currently have with this piece of legislation. You know, I mean, the people who worked on statutes before us and law obviously seen fit to have the current regulations in law, and we're changing a lot of this and giving you a lot more authority and discretion. You know, where do we start and stop on that, and at what level? And again, I think it's a good idea personally to go back and, in 5 years, if people apply for this, to at least notify the other people that could be affected by that and ask them, because we've got changes in the notification process. You know, I mean, you can ask the user, is there issues here? And they're going to say, no, I don't have any issues with that. Go ahead and sign me up for another 5 years, please. But, you know, how do we deal with that? I mean, it's hard to deal with every instance in the state where there's a lease or a use of water, a small lease. I mean, these are, you know, small uses, what's considered small. I think that's why in the statute, if you go back and you're required each 5 years to go and take a look at this and to examine it more fully instead of, you know, streamlining it. Sometimes streamlining is good, sometimes it's not good. But how do you deal with this in a statewide issue with these leases if you don't go back individually and look at them at least every 5 years? That's not asking too much. I have concerns about that. Any suggestions that help me on that?
Representative, through the chair, I think that I would have to respond to you that we do actually look at, I think, the concerns that you're talking about, which is what other uses might occur from the time that we first authorized it. Is there issues, like you're saying, the water's levels have changed, things like that. We will still look at that. I think the difference is that you're not going through, say, as formal of a decision process, but yet we would know, we would still be finding out, is there other interest? And this would be through public notice. We'd still notify the public that we are intending to do this, find out if there's any concerns that the public addressed or anything like that. And then the difference is you're not having to go through a decision process quite as, I'll say, robustly as before, because you've already been seeing what the use is occurring at that area. You've been monitoring it. A lot of the times where this might come into play is, like, for instance, on the North Slope, where we have ice roads or something like that, where you've got somebody that has a well out there at some company, and they're using repetitively the same ice road being built every winter. We have all sorts of monitoring that goes on that to understand how much water is there. We know what activities are going to occur in that area. We have figured out what the lake levels are and things like that. And plus, we have fish and game habitat permits that are issued, and they're out monitoring this at the same time. So there's actually quite a bit of information that's gathered during that period of time. I don't think we will be taking any actions with our eyes closed about what changes might have occurred from the first time. And I do understand what you're saying, that it is good to look, to find out what has changed. Is there any impact that we should be cognizant of before renewing? I think that we're saying is we would do that, but we want to be able to not have to go through a full decision process on it, rather just renew it once we've done those initial stages. So that's not technically all spelled out in the statute here, exactly the process, because much of that process is already spelled out in the Alaska Water Use Act. So that's why it's probably not as clear just by putting in just this specific change here.
And Mr. Chair, here's an issue that continues to develop, too, that I think is part of this. And as Mr. Winfrey said, there can be pretty broad-based. We continue to have Alaska State Troopers stop people just with dump trucks and stuff going across Big Lake, and people trying to get materials to build houses. The Alaska State Troopers are stopping them and saying, where's your permit? And I said, well, what do you mean, what permit? I mean, they're DOT licensed vehicle, their CDLs and all that. And so, well, you're on state land with a vehicle over 10,000 pounds. Now, this legislation or this statute is, or
on your no slope, you can't be driving across state land with, you know, dune buggies or exploration equipment stuff. That's the purpose of it. But yet, there's a fold over now. I mean, where the Alaska State Troopers interpreted this is state land as being a lake. And, you know, I had a guy had a flatbed with a bunch of logs on it, and he's going to build a log house out on Flat Lake. The only way to get there is to access through, across the lake. It's stopped by a trooper. Where's your permit? Well, it's 60 to 70 days to get a permit, you know, and quite a bit of paperwork. That job was lost. I mean, know that there was no cabinets put in there. I mean, that the house wasn't built. So all those people lost that job. There's a foldover to all these other statutes that play into this. And when you just say, well, we're not going to go back and look at these, I got real concerns about that, Mr. Chair. And I don't know how we can clarify that, but it affects a lot of other issues that we don't see unless you get contacted by your constituents every day, you know, and say, well, hey, we got these issues. And I don't know how we deal with that by just expediting everything.
Representative through the chair, it's not the department's intent at all to try to expedite to put less of a concern or consideration on protecting the resources. Some of the examples you're giving deal with what we speak to as the generally allowed uses that are in regulation, and there are limits of what you can and can't do without a permit, and those are called generally allowed uses. Throughout the state, we are cognizant of the fact that there's many people that are using state land without permits where they should have permits because they've exceeded the generally allowed uses. We do not have enough staff to be able to monitor everything that goes on in the state. We can't be everywhere at once. And typically what happens is where people exceed the generally allowed uses where they technically should have a permit, they don't have a permit, it doesn't come to our attention unless something goes wrong. At the point that it goes wrong, obviously we have to address it. But I will not speak on the record here saying that we will be able to catch every single thing that exceeds the generally allowed use by all means. There's too big of a state. So,
I can work with the department on this. This process. I don't want to continue to dwell on it.
All right. Okay. Thank you. Representative Fairclough had to leave, but we're not moving the bill out. We'll have it back, and hopefully you're here because she has some questions. We will go through public testimony once people ask their questions and then close it, and then we will have you back with the CS. Representative Guerra, and then Dugan.
Mr. Chair, I've got two questions, Mr. Winfrey, and I've got to get down at caucus to see if people will co-sponsor the Walter J. Hickel Highway Bill, as you requested. Expressway. No, now I'm not on it. I've got two concerns. One is I don't want people to be able to game the system on taxes. So you said people can choose between fiscal year tax payments or calendar year tax payments. Can they switch back and forth?
Representative through the chair, they would only be able to pick in a given year, which it is. Now, typically, once a company invests in their accounting to do it by calendar year or fiscal year, there's no reason to change it. But if, for some reason, let's say the company was sold and the new company wants to do it based upon a fiscal year, calendar year, as long as they can make the switch with Department of Revenue, with the Mine License Tax, with federal income tax, I would not say that they can't change it for us. I mean, at some point, they could change. If let's say, we had a company change or something like that.
Through the chair. Mr. Winifant, there are going to be some companies that do it for perfectly ministerial reasons, like you mentioned. Some companies, you know, might make more money if it's a fiscal year calculation than it is a calendar year calculation. And by letting them go back and forth, if they make more money in one fiscal year than they do in a calendar year, they're going to pick the fiscal year that year. And if they make more money in a calendar year, they're going to pick the calendar year that year. I don't want to let them do that. So I don't mind you saying it's got to be by fiscal year. I don't mind you saying it's got to be by calendar year. But I'm very concerned that you would let companies switch back and forth because there will be some gaming of the system. Does that make sense to you?
But Representative, the chair.
Excuse me. Wouldn't they lose 6 months in the period if you switch at the end of the calendar year and you say I'm going to fiscal year? Fiscal year don't end until the end of May. So you actually lose 6 months, or you?
You report even less income, possibly.
Yeah, but then when you pick fiscal year, you can't pick it again. You should have a date like January 1st to pick it, and then you send one or the other. But anyway, I think we lose time.
Representative through the chair, I understand what you're saying. I'm not an accountant, so I'm not going to say how it's actually done. We would be required to see, with no gaps in time, what they're producing. And at this point, I can get back to you on it, but I can't tell you what the actual procedure would be to switch between a fiscal year versus a calendar year. I can talk to the person who deals with the royalty accounting and get back to you on that, but that's the intent is we would not let gaps occur so that, you know, you have unreported periods.
Thank you, through the chair. I'm not worried about gaps. I'm worried about people switching back and forth depending on which, whether fiscal year or calendar year, lets them report less income. And then the point that Representative Thomas makes, I don't even know how you transition, because what are you going to do, report 6 months in 1 year, which, and then 12 months the next year? I don't know how that's going to work either.
Like I had said, I'd be happy to get back to you, find out how we would actually deal with that. Unfortunately, I'm not an accountant, so I can't tell you how that would be done.
Okay. And then through the chair, one other question. One other topic. I'm uncomfortable with the exemption of small operations. I don't see a definition of small operations in the bill. Is there a definition?
There's not a definition in the bill, Representative through the chair. What we have done a preliminary review of is for those people that are earning less than $10,000 worth of gross product or gross income from their mining, they're not paying royalty because of the way it ends up that they can make the exemptions for the amount to produce. So it's likely that our threshold, which would be set in regulation, would be somewhere in that area, but we do not actually define
through the chair. If you're going to exempt people from taxes, I think the legislature should make the decision at what level that is, not leave it to you. So I'm comfortable with $10,000 in gross revenue, but I guess I would like to see the bill say that. If that's your intention, I'm okay with it, but that should be in the bill in my view.
Representative through the chair, we could make an amendment if the committee feels that is what you want. Typically, when we set some thresholds that are in regulation, sometimes the legislature sets them. So really, it's your call on whether you want it in regulation or whether you want it in the bill.
All right. Thanks.
Also, it's on the record at 10,000, so one could challenge you. Representative Dugan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Unfortunately, I have several questions here that I hope will elicit short answers and get through all this stuff pretty quickly. In your presentation, you said a lot of times there's no interest in sales. Can you quantify a lot of times for me?
Representative through the chair, I cannot quantify an exact term. When I polled to find out how many times do we have competitive interest when we go out and do that procedure, it's extremely few times. There are times, let's say in Dead Horse, where we do some lease tracks where there is competitive interest, but the places where typically you have competitive interest is where there is a restriction of the amount of land available. Like if the state actually owns some land right next to a community or something like that. Most of our land is more remote than that because the municipalities take the close-in land. So when we're talking about remote, in the remote areas, it's extremely rare, maybe one or two times over the course, you know, of several years that somebody goes competitive.
Okay, I would like to have an actual figure there before this bill goes out. Secondly, I'm working now off of the governor's sheet, which he gave us, which sort of spells out what at least he sees are the important issues here. It says here that allow the Department of Natural Resources to seal bid procedures if appropriate. Can you tell me what if appropriate means there?
The decision that we would represent through the chair, the type of decision process we would go through is we would look at it and say, okay, do we have a situation where we think we, if we're supposed to maximize the revenues, which it tells us to do in statute, if we think that we could potentially get more money based upon having two people or more people in a room bidding against each other, that's one way to increase your revenues. But historically, we found that actually a sealed bid ends up getting us more money because they don't know what the other person's bidding and they bid more. So sealed bid typically ends up giving us more money than when we do an outcry. Because when you do an outcry, the place where an outcry is most advantageous is if you know there's heavy interest in one parcel and both people absolutely want it, then an outcry auction may very well be the right way to go. But when it's, yeah, I might be interested, might be, you know, that type of thing, then sealed bid is better because people, really, the one person who really wants it doesn't want to lose it, so they bid a lot higher. And we typically end up with more money that way.
Thank you. Could you give me some figures on that, please? In terms of what you, I don't know exactly how you would.
I don't know how. I don't know how I would actually do that.
Okay, but you can give me some figures as to what the auctions themselves would have, you think they would have, give us increased revenue. And if you would, I'd appreciate it. Can I continue, please? Thank you. Sort of bullet part point three here says, give the Department of Natural Resources more flexibility about when to issue negotiated land leases of land. What are we talking about when we say more flexibility?
The flexibility, Representative through the chair, the flexibility is about right now we have no flexibility to not go through the competitive auction procedure even if there's no competitive interest. We still have to do that. The flexibility comes that once we establish there's no competitive interest, to not have to go through that auction procedure. That's the flexibility we're speaking to.
Okay, thank you. When we are talking under, I think it's number four, where it says, you know, allow the department to renew mineral and land leases under certain conditions. What are those conditions, and for how long are you recommending that this happen?
Where, Representative, through the chair, where are you referring to?
It's bullet number four.
Under.
It says, allow the Department of Natural Resources to renew mineral and land leases under certain conditions. And I'm asking, what are those conditions?
Okay. Representative, through the chair, the conditions that we're talking about there are the good standing conditions. So for instance, if somebody is has not been making their payments, or they've violated their lease, or they've completely changed their development plan, they're doing something different than you originally leased them the land for, those would not be conditions to renew a lease under. Those would go through the whole reissuance and say, you've basically got a bigger project here, a different project, and you would go through a full process on it, tell the public about it, and go through that longer process. What we're saying, the types of conditions we're saying is when everything's pretty much the same. You're fit. We would ask for a new development plan, make sure that they are doing the same thing they started out with, the same process, or the same thing we told the public that was going on there. So nothing's changed. That's what we're really talking about. It's good standing. They've paid. They've abided by all the terms, and they're doing the same thing.
Sure. Thank you. So we're not requiring any opportunity for somebody else to try to get that land themselves?
Representative, through the chair, the part about going out and first asking for competitive interest is if somebody expressed that I am interested, this person has developed a lodge here, but now I'm interested in taking that lease, all right? What we would do is if somebody says they're expressing an interest, then we don't go through the shorter negotiated process. We go through the competitive process, during which time we would put up auction brochure and such, and part of the requirements would be that whoever's bidding against that, if they're going to keep those facilities, they're going to have to pay the original lessee, reimburse them for all the investment costs that they had put in to build the lodge, and they're not just going to walk away with the benefit without paying for it. Then, so that's sort of what we call pre-qualification of bidders. They'd have to put down a bid deposit and some things like that. So usually where we've had people come up and say, well, I might be interested in doing that, we tell them this is what it would take. This is the procedure you'd walk through. When they find out they would have to pay for the facilities there that are already built, they're like, well, no, thank you. And so the competition sometimes walks away at that point because people are looking for a good deal. And we're just doing a fair deal here.
Okay. When we talk about exempting small mining operations, there's a couple of questions embedded there, I think, for how long is that going to be the case? And the other is, do we have a definition of small?
Mm-hmm. Representative through the chair, when we're talking about the mining royalties, I use the term small just to give an idea that we're talking about small production, not small in stature, not small in area, it's small production. And when we talked about the 10,000 gross income, that's basically what we're considering small. But there is not a definition. If it were put in a statute, obviously that would be the limitation. Now, conditions, the thing about putting in regulation versus statute is if conditions were to change, and let's say gold prices change and whatever, you may want to adjust that dollar mark. If you say 10,000 is the mark now, but now all of a sudden prices change, you might want to adjust that. It's easier to do in regulation than to try to go back to the legislature each time and change that. So that's why we typically put something like that in regulation. But if the legislature wants to put it in the bill, we can do so. But that's when we're talking about small, that's what we're referring to.
Thank you. And I just have one more.
Okay, because we want to do public testimony here.
Okay. Then, Mr. Chairman, all I want is some idea of what time and cost savings are going to be if this bill passes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You can do that. Okay. We'll take public testimony. Does anybody in the room wants to testify on this bill? Not anybody on? We have one for questions. We have Cameron Leonard, who's been on the line for Department of Law for Fairbanks, but he's just for questions. So seeing none, public testimony will be closed. We're going to hold this bill over until this afternoon. Representative Jewell.
Just a question, Mr. Chairman. The request for information from Representative Dugan will be directed to the chair and distributed to the committee?
Hopefully by, I think it's the wishes of the co-chair to move the bill this afternoon, I believe. So hopefully they have the answers by then.
Cool.
And this will be brought up this afternoon, is my understanding. And speaking of this afternoon, we have 1:30. We have two bills, HB 296, Crime of Escape, HB 359, Sex Crimes, testimony by video conference. Then we're going to recess and, from 3:30 to 6:30, and we're going to take public testimony tonight, 6:30 to 9, HB 9, In-State Gasoline Development Corporation, public testimony. So with that, we will be adjourned. Thank you, guys.